From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Comic books aren't just for kids these days. Today we call them graphic novels, and they occupy their own section at bookstores. But what's behind their popularity? Is it true, as some say, that the genre sells itself?
It's simply more fun to read something if words and pictures are combined. There's just something instinctively attractive about it.
But even if that's true, comics didn't become a multi-million dollar industry overnight. There were pioneering publishers and visionary cartoonists. Will Eisner, for example, insisted from the start that comics could thrive in the literary marketplace.
To believe something like this back in the days when comic strips sold newspapers, to believe that there was a higher art involved really took a leap of faith.
In this hour, comic books have grown up, and we'll talk to some of the artists who helped to raise them, like legendary publisher Dennis Kitchen, who produced this 1972 song on his Ordinary label. It's called Wisconsin Wiggles by Robert Crumb and his Keep On Truckin' Orchestra. Later we'll talk to our Crumb and his daughter Sophie. But first, cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer. He started on his path to fame back in the 1950s with a cartoon strip for the Village Voice. Strip ran for 42 years and ultimately earned him a Pulitzer Prize. Pfeiffer went on to publish dozens of longer cartoon narratives, plays, screenplays, children's books. In a new memoir, Backing Into Forward, Pfeiffer says he dreamed of being a famous cartoonist from a very young age. He grew up poor in the Bronx during the Great Depression. As he told Steve Paulson, the Sunday comics were one of his greatest escapes.
Newspaper comics, which have virtually disappeared from the scene because they've been reduced to ridiculous sizes, were a very big, romantic, exciting feature back in the 1930s and 40s. And if you were out to make a living and help out your family during bad times, this seemed like a wonderful way of doing it. So there are endless numbers of teenagers, younger than I, already in the field and drawing proficiently, far better than I. Will Eisner, who I worked for, started out when he was, 15 or 16. Joe Kubert, who did Hawkman, started out at 17. Everybody was doing it because everybody needed to make a living, and they wanted to make a living at what they enjoyed doing, and why not? This was America, and they were first-generation Jews, a lot of them, and they had come here to basically act out their dreams, and they were in the process of doing it.
What were your favorite comic strips when you were a kid?
Well, there was Popeye by Elsie Chrysler Seigar, which was wonderful and inventive, and I was fortunate enough many years later to write the screenplay for the movie Popeye. But I was drawing Popeye as a kid of 7 and 8, drawing Popeye slugging somebody, getting slugged by somebody. I loved the adventure strips. I loved Milton Caniff's Terry and the Pirates. I loved Al Capp's Little Abner, which was wonderfully innovative and evocative. Then later Capp wrote a strip called Abby and Slats, which he didn't illustrate. It was by a great artist named Rayburn Van Buren. These things just drove me up the wall with admiration.
So here you were as a young kid. I mean, you say that you were putting together 64-page comic books that you had created by the time you were 10 or 11. So you had this dream of being an artist. And you also had a very difficult mother to deal with. Why did she loom so large in your life?
First of all Jewish mothers loom large in their sons' lives. Secondly, in those years, during the Depression, my father could not find a steady job. She was a fashion designer, so she was the breadwinner, and she was the mother, and she was the dominant personality, and she was articulate, and she was, at moments, out of her past, funny and eloquent. She spoke beautifully. She had a great style about her.
Well, this is a very affectionate description of your mother, and I had the sense reading your book that kind of your whole personality was constructed in reaction against her.
Oh, that's, of course. I mean, all of what you just said is true, and what's also true is none of us, my two sisters or I, could stand her because she was overbearing. She could only hear herself speak and couldn't hear another point of view. I asked my sister a couple of years ago, my younger sister Alice, can you ever remember when Mom said she was wrong about anything? And she looked at me and she said, are you kidding? but that was not unusual for parents of those days in the pre-Freud generation, when parents today are overeager to admit they're wrong. I do it 15 times a day to my children.
It's striking to me, at least the way you describe this now, that from very early on, you seemed to have the confidence that you would someday become a famous cartoonist.
I knew as a certainty that if I didn't make it as a cartoonist, I was not going to make it at all as anything. And this was not just my passion. It was my bid for some kind of cartoon immortality. What that would be, I had no idea. I just wanted to do a daily newspaper strip like the big boys.
Did you have faith that you were good enough to be one of those guys?
Oh, I was very arrogant at an age when I had no talent at all. It's painful to think that if I could look upon my work realistically in those years, I don't know what I would have done for a living, but it wouldn't be this.
Well, you write about how when you were 16, you walked into Will Eisner's studio and showed him some of your cartoons, hoping that you could hang out at his place. Tell me about that.
It was summertime. I needed a summer job. I looked him up in the phone book. I had worshipped his work for at least 3 or 4 years and had a whole dossier on him. I knew everything he'd ever done. And when he told me just how bad my work was, rather than slink out, which it was my first thought, I just began talking to him about him. I changed the subject. And he became aware that I knew his work 6 or 7 years, you know, going back to his very first work. And while he worked with some very gifted professionals as assistants, none of them gave a damn about his work or his career. They thought he was old hat, old-fashioned, and I was the first one to ever talk about him as an artist. So he basically had no choice but to hire me as a groupie.
What did you do in his studio?
I ruled pages. I filled in blacks when they had an area they wanted black, and Eisner used a lot of shadows and a lot of shading. He'd do the outline and fill, put in an X in where the black went. And theoretically, I was supposed to just keep within the lines of the shadow, the outline of it. And even that I couldn't do. I screwed up. You know, I exceeded. I just didn't have the control. But everybody was very patient. They thought I was funny. They thought I was a wise guy. And they'd like having me around. And slowly I learned how to do that. And then they put me on Coloring the Spirit Sunday pages. The A-page section was in color, of course, and I became the colorist on it. And then when Eisner was running thin on ideas and I had the hubris to point it out to him, he said, "You try writing a story," and I did. And from that time on, I was writing the Spirit.
So you basically learned to tell this particular strip, the Spirit, in his voice, in his style. When did you begin to develop your own style as a cartoonist?
When I came out of the Army, well, actually, when I was in the Army and began my story, Monroe, about this 4-year-old kid who gets drafted by mistake, I had to find a way, I knew, of telling a very damaging story in the height of McCarthyism and political repression, an anti-military story, an anti-authority story, when we were during the Korean War. So I had to find an unpolemic tone to tell it in, and I decided the only voice I could get away with was an innocent voice, almost as if this was an adult book for children. I mean a children's book for adults. And in all the work I do, the voice is all. Whichever voice I find for the particular work, including the memoir, that decides the fate of the work, and that decides how it will be centered. And so it was with Monroe, and then later with the other stories I wrote, which became long satirical stories. I mean, today they'd be called graphic novels or novellas anyhow. But there was no language for them then. There was no label for them. I just called them cartoon narratives, which is what I still think of them as. And I did a number of these and took them around to publishers, all of whom passed them around, all of whom loved them, and all of whom turned me down because they didn't know how to market them, and I had no name. So it became clear that I had to go out and get a name, and then maybe they'd publish me. I had the job of becoming famous before I get a book published. And they all had the Village Voice, this newspaper, this very new alternative paper on their desk.
This is what, the mid-1950s?
By the time I was noticing the voice on their desk, it was 1956. And so I went out and bought the paper. I had never seen it and liked it and decided that if I could get a cartoon in that paper, all these editors who didn't think I was well-known enough to publish, they would now think, why, the guy's famous. He's in the Village Voice. So that's what I did, and that's what they thought, and that's how I started my career.
And you at first, you were not paid for your Village Voice strip, were you?
At first, for 8 years, I wasn't paid.
So once you had your cartoon in the Village Voice, what do you think was unique about it? I mean, what made you stand out in a way that other people weren't doing?
The chapter in which I talk about my success after The Voice is called Lucking Into the Zeitgeist. We were just coming out of a period of McCarthyism and post-McCarthyism. People on the left were afraid to say what they thought, or very cautious to say what they thought. And I was coming out with a weekly strip that was saying what they thought out there in a newspaper. So what I started hearing comments about in the beginning was not how funny or fresh or innovative, but how'd I get away with it? How'd they let you into print? People were shocked. And it was the shock effect in the beginning that got the attention. And when we got past shock, I was working my way into being a craftsman.
Now, what's striking, sort of hearing about your career, is you were doing serious comics back in the 50s, way before anyone took comics that seriously. I mean, now there's kind of a cult of comics and of graphic novels, and to some degree you were doing this way before that. I mean, certainly before anything was labeled as a graphic novel. How do you look back on what you did?
I was delighted to have influenced others, whether cartoonists or writers or whoever they were. But mainly I was delighted to have found a way of using myself and growing into new areas of using myself and developing and learning and basically teaching myself how to do the thing I wanted to do most without really knowing where I was going at the time. I teach now, and I didn't know I knew how to teach. But one of the things I tell my students in this writing class, which is called Humor and Truth, and I teach at Stony Brook, Southampton, is when you start a piece, I don't want you thinking about it. Don't use your head. Just let that you will know that it has a chance to be good when you lose control and your characters take over, the words take over, and you're just basically taking dictation. And that's essentially what I was doing with the cartoon in 6 or 8 panels, and certainly in my other forms of writing. And then you go back, employ the brain, and start editing and fixing and polishing and correcting things. But in the beginning, the initial drive, the initial inspiration should not come from the head. It comes from somewhere else where the real thinking is going on.
Jules Pfeiffer is a cartoonist, playwright, screenwriter, book author, and illustrator. He's won many awards, including a Pulitzer Prize for his cartoons and an Academy Award for his short animation, Monroe. His new memoir is called Backing Into Forward. He spoke with Steve Paulson. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
This hour, we're talking about the comic book market for adults and the people who helped to create it. And that brings us to Will Eisner. Not all illustrators agree on what to call graphic novels, or even when the first one appeared, but most would agree that if there was a man who was instrumental in bringing them into the mainstream, it was Will Eisner. Eisner was best known in the 1930s and 40s as the head of a comics packaging firm and creator of a popular comic strip and eventual TV show called The Spirit. But it was Eisner's graphic novels that helped launch a comics revolution. Michael Schumacher recently published a biography of Eisner called A Dreamer's Life in Comics. He says Eisner always believed in the literary potential of sequential art.
You almost have to be visionary in your own sense to believe something like this back in the days when comic strips sold newspapers. Comic books were for 12-year-old cretins from Kansas City, as they said in those days. To believe that there was a higher art involved really took a leap of faith. And Eisner had the courage to take that leap. He was laughed at, you know, for it. And he just continued on. Even his spirit stories were stories, first and foremost. And it just continued on till he saw a longer form.
Just to kind of put this in some kind of historical context, this is pre-Superman, pre-Batman. This is before the comics had become even as ubiquitous as they were by the 50s.
In fact, Eisner had the distinction of turning down Superman when they came to him when he had the packaging firm.
A decision he may have regretted later on.
Siegel and Shuster approached him, showed him the work, or sent him the stuff in the mail. And he looked at it and he says, you know, kid, you better work a little bit more. This isn't anything anybody's going to be interested in. He got to tell that as a story for the rest of his life, how he turned down Superman. Well, he didn't like all the people fighting, you know, monsters or space aliens or whatever. He appreciated what they meant to the market. And he certainly would have plugged into it for the market. But he preferred to deal with humans in human adventures. When they have no superpowers to fall back on, you're relying more on story, aren't you? The spirit had no superpowers. Yeah. And that's a natural progression from comics to graphic novels, where if you're going to write something that's long, you better have a story to hold people's interest.
Yeah. Tell me about how the spirit came to be.
It was an unusual situation where several people coming together at the same time. There was a comics distributor, a syndicate, that was interested in creating a comic book. The comic book would be in color. It would be inserted into the newspaper, which is, to my knowledge, the only time that's ever happened. I don't think it's happened since, where you put a whole comic book in a newspaper of original material and so forth. Eisner got together with a guy named Busy Arnold, who ran a very, very successful comics business. And they worked out this character, this spirit. They had no idea what it was going to be.
There's a funny story you tell in your book, as a matter of fact, of the day when, was it Arnold who called him and said, tell me about the character? And Eisner hadn't really thought about it.
He just was struggling with it, trying to figure out what he's going to do.
He's on the phone and says, he's got a hat.
Yes. And he just starts drawing this character. They say, well, what would he be wearing? What would he do? And he said, well, he wears a mask, and he draws a mask over this, which became the thorn in his side, where the spirit never took off his mask. So he'd be standing waiting for a subway train with a mask. Imagine that today, if somebody's standing with a mask on waiting to get on the subway. This bothered him to no end. But he wanted this person to be human, so how are we going to do this? So he put on this sort of weird, you know, the mask and the coat, the blue suit, actually, and the hat, which was his little way of tweaking Busy Arnold, because it was the same kind of hat that Arnold wore. And the spirit was born.
What's interesting about this is the spirit is not a great story. It's not Eisner's ultimate creation.
No.
But it is so different from what other artists were doing at the time that as he did so many times in his life, it started a new trend in comics. So that comics up to that point had, as you said, superheroes fighting monsters.
Mm-hmm.
Eisner said, well, I like somebody who's got a lot of strength, but I want more than that, and set a standard for storytelling that others sort of had to follow.
I think it was Jules Feiffer who had the great line, you know, Eisner's the guy everybody steals from. And he admitted it himself to some extent, because this guy was actually creating the formula, even as he went along creating a formula and breaking it himself and moving on to the next thing. He was a pioneer.
One of the things that this leads us to is a discussion of the world of comics and Eisner in it. There was a lot of infighting among the creators, distributors, artists, and storytellers in the world of comics, wasn't there?
There was no model in those days to deal with. They had no, you know, way of knowing who do we give credit to for this? You have to think of these comic book shops that they had, or comics shops that they had in those days, where the head of the shop, so to speak, or the owner of the company would sit at the front like a school teacher, and they'd have rows of drawing tables. And they'd be passing stuff along. They'd be discussing things as they go along. And who knew who was coming up with what? It's like any other collaborative process, really. If you look, Al Capp, when he was doing Lil Abner, had a couple of assistants who, you know, had as much to do with the direction the stories were taking as Capp did. So it was very, very difficult to understand how should we pay these guys?
But this is another way in which Eisner sort of led the pack, wasn't it? He understood early on that he needed to be in charge.
Yes, and he understood that you have to keep your copyrights. And he just instinctively understood that and fought for that when they were creating the Spirit insert comic book.
So the Spirit was a success for a long time and was even revived later on, but that wasn't satisfactory for Eisner. Mm. This was just kind of a beginning of storytelling for him. He wanted more out of comics. So where did he go next?
I think most creative geniuses are restless people. And Eisner certainly was. He thought that comics could be used to educate. And he was able to explore that to some extent when he was in World War II. He worked out of Washington, D.C., and did posters and such for the Army or for the armed forces. Well, afterwards, he thought, let's take this a step further. He created a company called American Visuals, and they did a number of things along that line. Books that were published, comic books that were published on how to get a job, or I can't speak of one right off the top of my head, but let's say how to get a job as a plumber or something. He was working along that line, but he was also working very closely with the Army on PS Magazine, which was an absolutely radical concept at the time. We're going to have something that the soldiers, you know, would be given to soldiers that's instructive. He was the art director of PS Magazine, and he had any number of people tell him that his drawings even saved their lives. His concept here was is that there are people that can't read an instruction manual, but they can look at sequential art and see how to do some of these things.
All of this was training for the man he was going to become, though,
yes,
wasn't it? He, after this, with all of these different kinds of uses of art, is the father of the graphic novel.
That's always going to be up for debate, whether or not he actually fathered it or not. Eisner, though, deserves full credit for being the one to literally drag it into the public consciousness, and that's important.
Yeah.
He was a big enough name, and when Contract with God came out, he was able to use that to launch this whole other area of writing that he wanted to explore.
Well, let's talk about the Contract with God for a little while, because that was a big shift.
Yes, it was.
In his life, but also in the world of comic publishing. Mm-hmm. Where did it come from?
A Contract with God was just a culmination of a lot of things that had built up in Eisner's life and art up until that point. Everything from the Spirit and the way stories were told to the very tragic death of his teenage daughter of leukemia that made him extremely angry, and he felt he needed to say something to address this, but he didn't know how. This was how he ended up doing it, by telling this really, really moving and powerful story. It's really not even a graphic novel if you stop and think about it. Contract with God is a collection of four novellas. But this was what he was about, was taking things to the next level. How can I do this? How can I make this work? Whether it was a graphic novel of his own or an adaptation like Moby Dick, which he did for children.
Well, the whole world of graphic novels has changed.
Absolutely.
What did the rest of the comics world think of Eisner at the time? You say now, Jules Pfeiffer says every graphic artist steals from Eisner. What did the others think of him at the time? Crumb, for instance, was at first not very impressed.
Right. Crumb was not ever into, say, the superhero stuff. He thought that was silly. But he did like Eisner's graphic novels, and particularly the book A Life Force, which, at the risk of tipping my mitt, as they used to say, is my personal favorite of Eisner's. I think it's just a magnificent book. And Crumb, Dennis Kitchen told an interesting story about Crumb upon seeing this. He sent him a letter and followed it up with a phone call, said he'd been incredibly depressed and to the point of even thinking about suicide. And he read this, and it gave him a whole new perspective. It made him feel strong again that he should pursue his own art.
Michael Schumacher is the author of 10 books, including the biographies Dharma Lion, Crossroads, and There But For Fortune. His latest biography is called Will Eisner, A Dreamer's Life in Comics. Like many comics enthusiasts, he lives in Wisconsin. So, Will Eisner wrote some of the first graphic novels ever published, but it was Dennis Kitchen who published them. Back in the 60s, Kitchen was a long-haired hippie artist who was forced to self-publish his comics. So he founded his own company, called it Kitchen Sink Press. Over the next several decades, Kitchen brought hundreds of comics, books, and other novelty items to a growing American audience and helped shape an entire industry. Now, some of Kitchen's early illustrations have been published in a volume called The Oddly Compelling Art of Dennis Kitchen. And Strange Hemp sat down with him recently to talk about his drawings and many of the other works of art and music that he helped create.
Dennis, what's the music we're listening to?
That was R. Crumb and his Keep on Truckin' Orchestra, River Blues, the last 78 RPM recorded that I'm aware of, that we did as a bit of an in-joke because Robert collects old 78s and I collect old 78 RPM jukeboxes. So in the kind of anti-marketing campaign only crazy hippies could do, we decided to record it in an obsolete format.
So I want to go back to kind of the beginning of your life with comics. I think anybody who has had a life at comics surely began as a kid. What were comic books like then? What did you like reading?
I'm glad I had eclectic tastes. I liked the funny stuff like Little Lulu and Uncle Scrooge, but I liked Batman, Superman, and it was hard to avoid the horror comics and the crime comics. They were a little scary when you're little. But I swapped with kids in the neighborhood, mostly other young boys, and they thought only sissies liked the funny stuff, so I used to be able to get two or three for one when I'd swap a Superman and get three Little Lulus. I still think that was a good training on my part. It was also important to me to see that the medium itself had great potential, and it wasn't limited to just superheroes.
Well, most kids of your generation kind of outgrew their interest in comics, but comics really stayed with you and kind of grew up right along with you. At what point when were the first comics for grown-ups? When did those first show up?
Depends on how you define it, but if you mean the underground comics from the late 60s, they were the ones first produced by artists for a pure audience. Prior to that, there were comics I would regard as eligible for adults, but they were not perceived that way. I mean, for example, I mentioned Uncle Scrooge or Mad Comics by Harvey Kurtzman. They were perceived as kids' comics, but when we look back, I mean, they were very adult, very sophisticated. It's just the industry in those days did not realize there was a potential adult audience. And if you were an adult back in the 50s or 60s reading comics, you were regarded as a, how should we put it kindly, a slow adult.
Well, in hindsight, it's easy to see the brilliance of your discovery that comics would work for adults as well as for kids. But at what point did you begin to realize that there was a great adult market for comics?
I think when I was in college, I was discovering the new kind of Marvel revolution. Stan Lee began creating Spider-Man and Fantastic Four, among others. And when they began, they were completely different than any other kind of super comics that had been in the market before. These were superheroes who were neurotic and had problems and fought with each other. And prior to that, you have to remember the early Batman, Superman, and other superheroes, they were very two-dimensional, really goody-two-shoes characters. The villains were also very two-dimensional. There were no shades of gray. And what Stan brought was a certain sophistication and a completely young approach to these kinds of heroes. And they were completely refreshing to my generation.
Well, looking back over your life history, it sort of seems as though comics just never really let you go. So you just kind of continued with them. What was the first one you published and really sold? Was it Mom's Underground Comics?
Yeah, it was the self-published one I did myself because I didn't know how to approach a publisher. I didn't know that any publisher would realistically be interested in my work. And thus I had to basically in a larger scale do what I had done in grade school and high school, which is manufacture and distribute and market and be the collection agent and everything.
And this was the late 60s, so who was buying Mom's Underground Comics?
Well, this was the beginning of the hippie generation, and so it was mostly to college students, and anyone with long hair was presumed to be a potential customer. So I went to every head shop and used bookstore and music store and basically put the comics in on consignment, and then we'd go back a week or two later, see if they'd sold, and would replace them, collect the money. And to my astonishment, they were flying off the shelves. This was the summer of 69. I printed 4,000 copies, and I sold virtually all of them in my general neighborhood on the east side of Milwaukee.
Wow, summer of 69. That was the height of the student anti-war movement. Was that mostly what your comic material was?
To some degree, it was, yes. It was political. It was cultural satire. It was stuff about drugs and tentative things about sex. Every taboo subject that you wouldn't have seen in a comic prior to that, suddenly I and my peers thought we had the opportunity to comment on. It was kind of a period of liberation in general. And so comics that had always been perceived as being juvenile, suddenly we realized this is a medium, and it's no different than radio or TV or film or literature. You just have to remember that the counterculture, by definition, didn't trust anything that came out of the mass media. And so underground newspapers and underground comics were effectively the literature of that generation at that point in time.
So let's fast forward to the 80s. How did the scene change?
Obviously, the hippie movement didn't last forever, and in short terms, most of us ended up getting regular jobs and cutting our hair, and the comics that we were putting out began to be more difficult to distribute because those head shops we were counting on had their own problems, mostly legal problems, restrictions on selling smoking paraphernalia and so forth. And so we found ourselves, certainly in the mid-70s and late 70s, finding it tougher to get into the marketplace. But at the same time, the comic book industry itself was evolving in a way that made comic books no longer something distributed on newsstands, but distributed through specialty shops that we now would just generically call comic book shops. And where there had been virtually none of those when I was starting, there became hundreds and then thousands of them. And so basically what I did was I shifted my focus into what would less likely be called underground comics and became specialty comics and graphic novels. I began reprinting some of the classic comics, like Will Eisner's Spirit and Harvey Kurtzman's comics and Little Abner and Flash Gordon and that sort of thing. At the same time, I was encouraging young cartoonists who I thought were really good, but underground comic became kind of a misnomer at that point, and they became known generally as alternative comics or any term that would distinguish them from still the mainstream superheroes.
And so who were the stars of this second generation?
Some of the artists continued to be stars. Somebody like Robert Crumb has never really faded. He's only gotten bigger and bigger with time, and certainly someone like Art Spiegelman, who went on to create Mouse, and there were a number of them. But I took my greatest pleasure, I think, in getting somebody like Will Eisner, who was a previous generation artist, to basically get back into the industry. He discovered underground comics, became inspired by them, and he's the guy who basically created the graphic novel genre.
A lot of people attribute the start of graphic novels to Eisner, but those first graphic novels that he did them with you. So really we owe graphic novels to you, don't we?
Well, technically, the first one he did was with a small company he invested in that went out of business very quickly, and then I inherited it. And then I ended up doing the next 18 or so of his graphic novels. So, yeah, we had a close relationship. It was great, even though superficially it wouldn't have looked like we had much in common when we met. He was balding and had a three-piece suit and was about 25 years older than me, and I was long hair with, you know, kind of classic hippie boots and probably tie-dye pants. And as Will Eisner once put it, we both smoked pipes, but with different substances. And yet what we had in common was not only a love of the medium, but a belief that the potential of the medium had really not been fully developed.
Thinking about all the different ways this comics business has changed, does it mean something different today to be a comic or graphic novelist than it did, you know, 20, 30 years ago?
Absolutely. I would say today, people who are working in this field now are proud to say they create graphic novels. The generation of Will Eisner and Harvey Kurtzman, I can tell you from their own comments, back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, when they would be at a cocktail party and someone would say, "What do you do for a living?" If they said they were in the comic book industry, people would take their drink and walk away. It was not a respected profession. When I began going to college, and I wasn't sure what I was going to major in, and I thought, well, I should take some art classes if I want to be a cartoonist, but I quickly found out that the hostility to comics was intense. All of that has changed so that now it's, for better or worse, a more respectable profession, but it didn't come easily, it didn't come overnight.
Well, Dennis, in addition to publishing the works of countless illustrators over the last several decades, you also published audio projects with a lot of them. We heard that old 78 RPM a little bit earlier. Is there anything else you brought for us to listen to?
The other thing I brought is a picture disc that I published back in, I think, the 80s, and it's a song that Will Eisner wrote in the late 40s called "Every Little Bug." And I don't think it was recorded at the time, but we had the sheet music, and so we got some contemporary musicians to record variants of it. And then it alternates, though, with dialogue from a late 40s spirit TV show. So that's a very dramatic, almost kind of a radio dialogue.
Later, at Wildwood Cemetery, secret headquarters of the spirit. Okay, Ebony, here, go buy yourself all the sodas you want, only... stop that creaking!
Be with us again tomorrow, same time, same television station, for the next thrilling chapter in The Adventures of the Spirit. The Adventures of the Spirit appears in leading comic magazines from coast to coast.
The firefly don't have to cry. He knows from the glow that it's his gal gone by. Oh, every little bug has a honey to hug but me. And even Noah, when building his ark, would never keep one lonely lark or refuse.
Dennis Kitchen is an illustrator and publisher who founded Kitchen Sink Press in 1969. Today, he operates Kitchen Lind & Associates, a literary agency for graphic novelists. His new book is called The Oddly Compelling Art of Dennis Kitchen. He spoke with N. Strain Champs. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking about graphic novels and the world of adult comics. And there may be no comics artist more celebrated than Robert Crumb. Known widely as R. Crumb, some of his best-known works include Mr. Natural, Artistic Comics, Weirdo, and his 2009 graphic novel, The Book of Genesis. One of his latest projects is a compilation, not of his drawings, but those of his daughter, Sophie. It's a kind of biography of drawings, and it's called Sophie Crumb, Evolution of a Crazy Artist. When Robert and Sophie Crumb stopped by our studio recently, they told Steve Paulson that Robert and his wife were compulsive archivists of his daughter's drawings from the beginning of her life.
I started archiving her drawings when she was 2 years old. I dated them, and sometimes when I would ask Sophie, Sophie, what's this drawing mean? What's this going on here? And she would tell me, you know, when she was 3 years old, and I would write down what her explanation was of the drawings. Like, you know, this is a snake chasing a girl, so I would write that down.
And in the book, that his comments are noted down in the book. So
sometimes.
It's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Funny.
Well, this is really unusual. I don't think I've ever seen a collection of an artist's work going back to when she's 2 years old.
I've never seen a book like that, tracing somebody's development through drawing from the time they first start drawing up until, you know, full adulthood.
And we had so much stuff. We just had so much of it. Like,
I haven't
done that much stuff for print. I really haven't done that much stuff professionally, but there was so much sketchbook drawings and just random loose drawings from my whole child up till now. That was a huge body of, but not work, but it wasn't really work. It was just leisure drawing and just personal drawing and diary type drawing. It was so much of it. Made sense to make a cool book out of it, you know?
Yeah. No, I found your pictures, I would say, probably around the time you were five or so, to be really quite remarkable. I mean, not only your ability to draw representational figures, but just the imagination that you have in a lot of these.
Yeah, it was wacky. It was wacky.
It was wacky. So looking back, why do you think you liked making art so much?
Well, seems kind of obvious. You know, I had wacky stuff around me all the time. They were drawing. There was weird paintings on the wall. They were always drawing. They were always encouraging me to draw, always reading comics to me, watching wacky old 30s cartoons, Little Lulu, and reading Little Lulu and watching Betty Boop, and completely overstimulated, overly like brainwashed with all the stuff, you know.
We made you crazy.
That's part of the crazy, yeah. There you go. The crazy just made perfect sense.
Yeah. So, Robert, was this kind of deliberate to you know, show your daughter,
oh, yeah,
you know, you know, the Three Stooges and Little Lulu
completely
and all this kind of
yes,
stuff?
Yes, it was absolutely deliberate. Because in my mind, that stuff was, you know, I'd selected that out from the time I was young as the best stuff of American popular culture. And compared to when Sophie was growing up in the 80s, I thought the current stuff from the 80s wasn't very interesting, generally
and
speaking.
And you liked watching Three Stooges with me, too. We all watched it as a family.
Yeah, when I would watch it with her, or, you know, read the comics to her and, you know, all that stuff. So it was stuff that I enjoyed. Soon I could watch Hal Roach comedies.
He did the voices, too. Hey, Lulu. Hey, Tubby.
So this is, I mean, it's really fascinating. I mean, this is sort of, you know, your vision of a, not just a cultural education, maybe a classical education.
Yeah, classical education, yeah.
So Robert, what did you think of Sophie's art when she was little? I mean, did you think her talent was unusual?
She's a genius.
She's a genius. She's definitely seemed completely inclined to spend a lot of time drawing. We didn't have to say, Sophie, get to work and start drawing. She liked drawing. She really took to it. She liked to spend long periods of time concentrated on drawing or making things. She was very good at cutting out little paper dolls and little. Yeah. She started making these pop-up books or drawings when she was like, I don't know, 5 years old, six years old.
Tons of paper dolls.
She cut out these intricate things. So, you know, sort of exceptional. Yeah,
the key
but
is that it always stays play. It never becomes work. The key.
Is that possible though, to make it to keep it always as play? I mean, I would think actually that would be hard once you're sort of really
like
fine tuning it.
I would like to. That's why I'm not really a careerist. I like to draw in my sketchbook more than I like to, you know,
make money
or make drawings for money or make drawings with the intent to sell them.
The key word
that's why
there
the book. Some that's why the book, you know, is that has that much stuff in it, and that much interesting stuff, I guess, because I didn't do it thinking about anyone else but my, you know, personal, wacky, whatever, stream of consciousness.
The key word there
is
money.
Okay, I'm ranting.
it's when you have to start doing it for money, that's when it becomes work.
Yeah, that's when it becomes a chore, and then you're thinking too much, and it just takes away from the.
Is it going to sell? Or if you have a boss who wants you to draw certain things.
It hurts the art.
It does, yeah. problem is we all have to make a living in this world.
Yeah, well, I'll sweep the streets.
So, Robert, when you look back over your career, Robert, I mean, how much of it would you say was for money, and how much of it was just because it was
he always wanted to be a famous cartoon.
I would say that I'm more entrepreneurial than Sophie.
Oh, yeah.
I always was. You know.
When you were young, you said you wanted to be a big, famous, well-known cartoonist.
I wanted recognition, yes,
for
my work. Oh. That was my way of overcompensating for the fact that I was extremely alienated and unpopular with girls.
And you got what you wished for.
I got everything I wanted. Everything.
So comics was the magic ticket.
I got it all.
No, you obviously, Robert, are a very proud parent. I mean, you know, you were one of the editors of this book of Sophie's Art. You are, of course, also a legend in the world of comics. And here was your daughter.
The legend.
Also drawing comics at an early age. And I could imagine you might respond in a couple of ways. You could be very encouraging, or you might think, you know, maybe she'd be better off trying something else.
Like law school?
Or a different kind of art that didn't resemble her father's so much in some ways.
Well, you know, I was kind of worried about her being the daughter of a famous person. That's always can be a problem for anybody who has a famous parent, you know. Do they follow in the footsteps, you know, like Jane Fonda or something, you know.
But did you think I was good enough at the comics to pursue it? Like, you weren't going to be like, you shouldn't really get into that, you know.
Quite the opposite.
Yeah,
and the opposite problem is that she's so good that, you know, if she she starts to do what I did, make comics, she's going to get a lot of, you know,
I think you're the only person in the world that thinks that, because I'm not that good at drawing comics, actually. But thanks, Dad.
Actually, you are, in fact. But Sylvia never showed that much, like, motivation to do art as a career. She just, you know, I think she felt that she should or ought to, you know, make a living with her skills, but I don't think she really...
Because whenever I would try to I did publish a few comics, it always just became this chore that would just, like, mess with my head, because I would start thinking, they compare me with the legend, and they did. They bashed me to pieces.
Boards, right?
And it just, the whole putting it out for the world thing doesn't work for me.
So, to ask about that. I mean, here you were, you know, working in the same field as your father. How much did that weigh on you?
It was hard. It was hard, but it got better when I moved out, when I got away from them, kind of found my own identity, and I grew up a little bit when I'm in my early 20s. Got better. I managed to actually finish a few comics. But before that, as a teenager, I was just real frustrated with myself and, you know, never thought it was good enough and blah, blah, blah. And then I managed to actually finish a few comics and put them out, but there's too much
baggage
behind that. I don't want to be a big famous cartoonist, and I never will, obviously. I'm not.
What?
I don't have the humor.
You got the humor. You got everything it takes except the motivation to be commercially out there.
I don't want to be necessarily a professional. I don't care if my whole life I'm just drawing in sketchbooks and then living a nice life with my family. That sounds fine to me.
That's very French.
French.
That's a really bizarre drawing you're doing here while you're talking.
I know,
so
it's twisted.
Wait, now I can't see it. Can you describe
thank God. Well,
it's this girl with these giant breasts,
and
then down below there were the where the sex organ's supposed to be, there's like a keyhole, and then these spread kind of balloony legs. It's bizarre.
Okay, well, I'm glad you mentioned that because, I mean, Robert, of course, you are famous, notorious for the way you draw women, often with huge breasts and large behinds. They are often leered at by rather creepy and repulsive men.
including myself.
Sophie, what did you think of this? You know, the way your father would draw women.
You know, it was kind of embarrassing, kind of weird, kind of. But he doesn't have a perverted or bizarre behavior towards his family, like I always say. So, gets in comics, stays in comics. What happens in comics, stays in comics. And I tend to avoid my eyes when it gets to devil girls decapitated and stuff like that. I'm like, nah, no.
Do you think there's any kind of inherited quality? I mean, the fact that art runs so strongly in your family?
Yeah. Well, all I know is Sophie really took to it.
I have no credit.
So, I mean, I don't know whether it's genetic or what. I have no idea how much of it's genetic, how much of it's family influence. But it's true that there was a strong impulse to draw in my family.
It's the big question of the book, I guess.
My two brothers both were exceptional artists also. Part of the thing that makes an artist exceptional like Sophie is that she just kept doing it, just kept at it.
Hmm. So Robert, did you know from a very young age that you were going to be an artist? I mean, that this is what you were going to do with your life?
Yes, I did, because my brother Charles told me that's what I was supposed to do, and that's what I
did.
He constantly made me feel like I was nothing unless I was drawing. So I knew from the time I was 8 years old and 9 years old that's what I was going to be doing. I was going to be a cartoonist.
Did you like it? Did you enjoy it? Or did you want it? Or did he just tell you, he ordered you?
That's a good question. I didn't always enjoy it. It was like a job I just had to do.
He forced him. He gave you that the work ethic.
Yeah, no, I was just kind of a wimpy kid, like passive and wimpy, and I just kind of, he was very dominant and forceful.
Charles was the real genius,
he was
actually.
The force, behind the
but
whole thing.
He was
thing.
So crazy that he never got out of his house, got out of his mom's house. Nope. Too much of a genius. Huh.
So, Robert, when did you know that, like, professionally, this was your thing? I mean, that you were good enough to
well,
be
I couldn't do anything else. I had no other skills. I was completely imbalanced. If I wasn't going to be an artist for a living, I would have to, be a stock clerk. And that, actually, when I left home, I didn't think I was good enough to be a professional artist. I went to Cleveland, and I looked for jobs as a stock clerk in the department stores. I went to the Ohio State Employment Agency, and
But also, you're completely socially handicapped.
Yep.
You can't drive. You can't swim. You're dyslexic. You can't. You're blind almost. He compensates all that by just drawing all the time. And see, I want to have a life. I don't want to be like that. I like to drive. I want a motorcycle.
That's healthy.
Yeah, I'm not that imbalanced, so I'll never be this huge, famous legend. I don't want to be. I want a life. You understand? So, you compensate all that.
So a certain amount of imbalance.
That's where genius comes from.
Genius comes from imbalance.
Absolutely.
Sophie and Robert Crum have collaborated on several comic strips. Sophie's produced her own series, Belly Button Comics, and is a co-editor with her parents of Sophie Crum, Evolution of a Crazy Artist. They spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again or check an author's name, find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website, ttbook.org, where you can stream audio or download a podcast. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 130A, Graphic Art Grows Up. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Aaron Kloon, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.